KCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. In suburban Boston, a jury has acquitted Karen Reed of killing her ex-boyfriend, Boston Police Officer John O'Keefe, in 2022, but has found her guilty of drunken driving. WBZ's Emma Friedman.
Karen Reed was sentenced to 1 year probation for the OUI. While walking out of the courthouse, cheers erupted from her supporters, dressed in pink, holding up the American Sign Language symbol for I love you.
About a year ago, a separate jury deadlocked on the second-degree murder charge. President Trump says he hasn't made a final decision about ordering airstrikes on Iran.
Israel's done a very good job of that, but we'll see what happens. The bottom line is they can't have nuclear.
The FDA has approved a twice-a-year HIV prevention injection. Here's CBS's Alexander Tin on the Health Watch.
The drug is called lenacapavir, branded as Yeztugo by drug maker Gilead Sciences, which is touting the medication as a major breakthrough in the fight against HIV.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers get rained out. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Baseball, Brewers and Cubs are supposed to play tonight at Wrigley Field, but steady rains, game has been called. They'll move tonight's game to August 18th and a doubleheader at Wrigley Field against the Cubs. Chicago winning last night 5-3. The Cubs doing a good job this season closing out games. They are 40-1 when going into the eighth inning with the lead. NFL, I had a chance to talk to the Packers' new president and CEO, Ed Policy, yesterday at Lambeau Field, and asked him, when he takes over for Mark Murphy this summer, what are the things he wants to focus on?
The Packers, the entire organization really exists for three things and three things only, and that's to win football games, to keep the Packers in Green Bay, and to strengthen our community. So I'll be really focused on those three things, and the next big thing will be first and foremost to focus on fielding a very competitive football team that's hopefully competing for championships.
That's the Packers' new president and CEO, Ed Policy, with Sports on Mike Clemens.
At Hazelden Betty Ford, treating mental health isn't just about breaking old patterns, it's about braving new ones. As the leader in alcohol and drug treatment for 75 years, we know caring for addiction, anxiety, depression, and trauma goes hand in hand. We're here for you with new tools when life breaks down. Discover your path to better mental health at hazeldenbettyford.org/Wisconsin. Sponsored by Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, Wausau's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Not in a good place today. Not in a good mood, not in a good place, not happy. And I got to tell you, I don't have, in this moment, great hope for this country. I got to be honest, this latest disgrace coming out of the White House, this latest Trump executive order that will, I guess, allow VA doctors to now refuse to treat veterans, not for medical reasons, but for their politics, their marital status, their union affiliation. You know, if you're a Democrat, if you're not married or you're a union supporter, you can now evidently be denied care at a VA hospital if you're a vet. It's amazing. These are our heroes. These are the people we put on a pedestal. These are the folks who... These are the folks we worship, and yet, now because of, it's not freedom. What we're seeing is fascism, pure and simple. And look, millions of working class veterans who fought for this country, only to now be told that their health care depends on their loyalty or how they voted in the last election or who they love. And look, it's not just unethical. It's un-American. I mean, this is a direct attack on working people. This is an attack on women, on LGBT veterans. This is an attack on anyone who doesn't pledge dear leader loyalty. And we even are hearing about doctors who are being fired for their political beliefs or their labor activism. Since when did serving your country become a political litmus test? When? What we're seeing is this is a war on science, it's a war on medicine, and it's a war on basic dignity. Let's be very clear about what's going on here. This isn't about defending women. This is about consolidating power. This is about punishing dissent. This is about turning veterans' health care into a tool of political control. The working class is being sacrificed again, like always. And if we don't stand up now, tomorrow it won't be just the VA. It'll be our jobs, our rights, our lives, all of it. When do you go enough is enough? And look, you know, if you'd have told me this 10 years ago, I'd have said, no, this country wouldn't stand for this. This country's, you know, we love our heroes. We put them on a pedestal for a reason. We're going to take care of them. We're going to take care of each other. We're a better country than this. We're told we're a good, God-fearing country. And yet today I had one of those moments. This story just compounded my anger for the day. As you know, my wife was in a serious motorcycle accident back in September, near fatal. She is never going to be who she was. I fear she's never going to be functional. She's getting stronger physically. She's getting better. She's walking around. She's able to do things physically. But mentally, she may never return. And she's tired all of the time. So today, when we had doctor's appointments, they scheduled two of them first thing in the morning, and then the third one 3.5 hours later. We needed a place to find to let her lay down for a little bit. And there was a couch up in a lobby, you know, away from virtually everybody else. And on three separate occasions, we had people from the facility come in and harass her laying down. And I couldn't help but think that these are people who are in a care industry who show no compassion whatsoever. None. And these are people who should not be in the healthcare industry, in the care industry. And what it came down to is they thought that we were homeless. And I don't know why that would matter. Because look, I hadn't showered. My hair was a mess. I have a giant bag because I have to carry all kinds of things. I was told I look like a homeless bad guy. Throughout this whole process, I've learned a lot of patience, a lot of self-control. Because here's what I know. I know in the world that we're in right now, if I'm me, the normal me, I'm going to get locked up. Because, we've now passed laws that being angry is against the law. And if that happens, if I do get locked up, I don't know what happens to her. She's not able to care for herself. And all we wanted to do was lay down for a little bit, take a nap, and regenerate. Rejuvenate. And yet, on multiple occasions, these people, you know, made, you know, obvious threats. And it got me to thinking that, you know, maybe we're not the country anymore that I grew up in. Maybe we've been trained to not care about each other. I look at what the Senate's doing to Medicaid, and I don't see the outrage that I think is that would be sufficient. I had hoped that the Senate would be the place where some sanity, that they would be the place that would go, no, this is too far. But no, they're going to cut Medicaid, and I'm told from what I'm reading, Medicare is on the block as well, because we have to fund dear leaders' tax cuts. And how are we going to do that? We're going to do it by rationing health care. rationing care to poor people especially, to veterans. And I have to say, I'm distraught. I'm distraught by what I see in our common humanity, because I don't think it's there. I fear that we've so been broken by the harsh edges of our political rhetoric. And this is the Trump effect. I put the blame at his feet. This is coming out of the pandemic and all of the organizing that went around to tearing down government because it was politically expedient. I look at this and in this moment and fear that the country I love is not the country I believe it to be. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Have you had similar encounters? Do you feel the same way? And what can we do to make it better? I want to hear your thoughts. Right back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, one of the major things that gets bipartisan support, nonpartisan support, just actual support, is investing in upgrading our internet service. I don't know anyone who doesn't complain that their Wi-Fi service sucks, that you get out into the hinterlands and you're lost. And look, if we're going to be a society where the internet is it? Having connectivity is prosperity? Well, maybe we should have an infrastructure that makes that possible. And look, one of the things I think Joe Biden did absolutely positively right was investing in rural broadband. Someone who lives in a fairly rural area, this is important. So now to see Donald Trump and the Republicans, and I got to think, just because Biden's name was on it, they're going to kill it. Or there is the other thought that, you know, this is the reason that Elon Musk spent $280 million to get him elected, so that they would kill investment in rural communities. So all you'd be stuck with is that crappy Starlink. But here to share some thoughts and maybe set me straight, I've asked Marcus Chambers to come talk with us. He's the Communication Workers of America's Broadband Brigade state leader in Maryland. He's the guy who spends, this is what he works on. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here and share some thoughts and information.
So let's start first and foremost. What's going on? What's the potential impact of the policy changes on rural communities, access to high quality broadband? What's going on?
It is a sweeping impact. Back in March, a certain part of Congress decided to initiate what's called Speed for BEAD. And fast forwarding to June, just a couple of weeks ago, it came to fruition. Everything was stopped, and all the states have to reissue new proposals. So all the progress that had been made, including states like Nevada, Delaware, and West Virginia, that had everything finalized, boots ready to hit the ground this year, we're talking like within months, if not weeks, full stop. They have to redo all their plans and basically start over from scratch with these brand new mandatory statements that have been issued. So it's a complete rework of everything at this point.
And what's the sense of this? Am I missing something here?
the sense that it seems like is they want whatever's cheap, and they don't want to invest in what's right for the people to have true broadband. Is kind of what we see happening. We had fiber as a technology that was going to be the preferred. It's reliable. It's sustainable. It's an investment. And they're saying, hey, this is looking like it might not be the cheapest thing we can do to get it out there. So let's, you know, quote unquote, save some money. And let's let these other technologies enter and rewrite the language so it's more beneficial for them.
So basically, you know, maybe I'm not off with the crappy Starlink because the argument is, well, you don't need to lay wires. You don't need the most reliable way of getting the high speed internet. No. Let's do that.
I mean, yeah, sure. Let's do that. Let's launch rockets up every 5 years because the satellites only last 5 years at a maximum. Otherwise, they're going to be falling down on your heads, whether scheduled or unscheduled. You know, why do we want to run cables to people's houses so they have a dedicated line that is their signal that guarantees their service versus making them go through hub systems where based on traffic or time or day or weather or amount of clouds, et cetera, you might have limited service or no service at all. So again, why invest in quality when you can just roll it out fast and cheap and let come what may of it?
So just
that's what's happening.
So just to lay the groundwork a little bit, the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, this came out of the Biden, infrastructure bill to invest, what was it, $42 billion in broadband, and the BEAD stands for Broadband Equity Access and Deployment. So, you know, when I saw that, my first thought was, well, the word equity's in there. Maybe that's the reason. Maybe this is, because I don't think anything happens in this administration about policy that makes working people's lives better. I think it's all just political payback and loyalty. So the loyalty part is, you know, Elon's going to get wealthier, but there's also that political ideological side. We can't have equity. Sorry.
That is definitely a significant possibility. We don't really look at it from that. It really seems to be not so much an emphasis on the equity part of it as it is look at what we say we're saving.
Yeah.
Because instead of, again, looking at the investment where you have a little bit of money coming in up front and you have a structure set that's going to last you 50 to 100 years, they're saying, hey, look how quickly and cheaply we can roll this out and not looking at the continued cost over time. So, you know, like when you buy a refrigerator or a stove for your home, do you want to buy something that is the best you can afford so you don't have to worry about it for 10, 12, 15 years? Or do you just buy whatever the cheapest thing is and you're replacing it every 2 years? So they're saying, hey, this is cheap. This saves everybody money. Look at how much we're saving because of Doge wanted to talk about. We're going to save the government, the people, $2.5 trillion,
yeah,
which they never did. It's the most spendy administration in history to this point. They're hiding it under the guise of, let's look at how much money we're going to save and see how cheap it is, when in actuality, it's going to be more expensive and more detrimental. And it's not going to eliminate the digital divide currently in place as is.
Yeah, I mean, let me just tweak that a little bit. You know, they'll spend money on things that are important to them, enriching the very wealthy. But anything for the working class, screw them. And look, these were going to be really good jobs. These are going to be good, you know, union jobs with labor standards. So how does, you know, the elimination of some of these requirements, especially for, you know, the idea of having fair labor practices and workforce development plans, how's that going to affect state broadband programs like in Maryland or Nevada or in West Virginia? How's it going to help or harm creating the good jobs that we were banking on? I think I lost him.
It's going to be a huge impact. All the labor standards that we had in place. No, I'm here. Hello.
Yeah. No. This is the reason why we need really good, high quality internet, so that you
can
don't
you
have
me?
These kind of things that happen and happen far too often. As someone who does this a lot, this is a reality of the world in which we live in. And the sad reality is, if we're not going to spend money investing in upgrading our ability to do things, this is what's going to happen continually and into the future, and get worse.
No, it definitely is. It's a stopgap measure that they're putting in place when we have a long-term investment to truly make it equitable, have it affordable, make it something that's reliable. And you're looking at the labor standards that we had in place everywhere. All the states had built upon the initial government framework for quality jobs, high road labor standards, you know, functional in-state employees versus these cash grab companies that want to contract and subcontract out. So what does that mean? That means you're going to have companies come in and the workers are going to be done by the lowest bidder, which means you're going to have corners cut, which means safety standards aren't going to be met. So you've got short-term and long-term problems left and right when that happens. I've got multiple examples of injuries, people having to leave their homes temporarily and permanently. You know, there's been loss of life issues. There's communities that are still struggling. You know, you got to do a doctor's appointment or do your homework in a parking lot at a Panera Bread versus having quality internet at home. You know, fiber, you can have so many connections that we're not tapping into an infinitesimal percentage of what it can do versus satellite. If you got two or three people on it and you're buying in the wrong tier, you have a lower priority, your speed's going to be dropped, or you might not be able to be connected at all. So people still can't do what they need to do with this reworked NTIA mandatory guidelines that are coming through.
So let me ask,
it's a complete...
Now, I'm glad you hit on this, because, you know, there's a difference between cable and fiber and internet, and there's a bunch of phone, you know, are we still using phone lines to get internet to people? You know, there's all of this stuff that is yesterday's technology. We're talking about upgrading to today's and even pushing the, you know, tomorrow's technology a little bit. To me, that's the country we used to be, pushing the bounds of technology and getting the best we can possibly get. This cheap, quick fix stuff, this isn't who we've been.
No, it hasn't been, and it's really alarming to see that we're going back to that. We really are doing this stopgap, look at what's happening right now and not considering the impact it's going to have going forward in the future for our economy, for our labor, for closing the digital divide so everybody can do what they need to do as they need to do it. It is the biggest problem happening. And like I said, we had several states ready to go. Everything signed off, everything approved. The sub-grantees, the companies were picked. And all we had to do was get the word go, and then this happened, and they've got to start all the way over from the beginning. So they brought it in saying, look at how long this has taken to get, and no shovels have hit the ground, so we're going to stop this and do this new thing. But this new thing is stopping where everybody was, which was ready to go. So you're not speeding anything up, you're slowing it down. And it's going to be 6 months, if not into 2026 or 27, before shovels hit the ground now. Because one of the key details that people are missing is they see the 90 days, but the 90 days of that proposal, when it goes through, the NTIA will respond. It doesn't say approve or finalize, it says respond. Right. So you could be looking at 90 days plus 90 days plus 90 days because they're responding, but they're not finalizing anything. There's no guarantee in that. So it's presented as, look at how cheaply and quickly we can get this out, but we don't know when anything's actually going to be out because of how it's worded. And we already know it's going to be worse technology that is under consideration now. Why would you want worse technology when America, like you said, has always been pioneering and leading with the best? We're no longer doing that.
You brought up the digital divide. You know, I live in a fairly rural community. For me to get gig service and significant upload service, I almost had to give them my first male-born child. I mean, it's like $400 a month. It's crazy to get the kind of service that I need to do what I do. And where if I were living in a major city, it would be probably half that. If I was living in another country, I had a friend who was coming on the show weekly from the Himalaya Mountains in India and had better internet service, better connection, and for like $16 a month because they've invested in it. We haven't. So the question then becomes, Marcus, you know, for those of us who live in red America, in rural America, isn't this administration just jabbing us in the back by slowing this down? I mean, if this administration was in power back when they put plumbing in houses or electricity in houses, we may still be going in odd houses and lighting candles.
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, you're standing on the rug and they pulled it from under your feet. And when you fell down, they said it was your fault, not theirs. But they literally pulled the rug up from under people. Like I said, we had three or four states that were ready to go. We had another half dozen or so that in 1 month they would have been ready to go. And they just pulled the rug up from under it and said, hey, you fell over. Start over with these new rules from scratch. That's not faster. That's mitigating and slowing down any progress that we were hoping to have.
What happens to that $42 billion that's been earmarked to invest in our infrastructure for broadband? What happens to that money now? What happens? Does it go back in the coffers? Do they celebrate and say, look how much we save? What happens to this? Do we know?
It will be, as we know it now, it will be redistributed under the new guidelines, not the old guidelines. So everyone that was earmarked to get that money, they're probably not going to get that money unless they can restructure their processes to meet the new requirements. So it might be all $42.5 billion that gets spent, or it might be part of it. And then the government, quote unquote, will pocket the rest, or instead of being distributed where it needs to be to get broadband to everyone, one company or two companies may get it and they profit instead of the people benefiting.
And again, I come back to this focus because, you know, this is near and dear to my heart. I was really hoping, hey, you know what? We might get some actually decent internet through here, and I might have some competition, some choices. There may be, you know, I might get the Verizon, high speed thing, the fiber. Who knows? This doesn't give me hope. It's almost like, you know, they've stabbed us in the back over this, and I'm furious. So last question I've got for you. You know, what should we be doing? What actions, what policies do you recommend? What things do you suggest we do to ensure that, you know, they do what they say they were going to do? They do invest in the long-term value of reliable service, of the good jobs that our community needs. What do we do?
You got to make your voice heard. You got to reach out. You got to go to your local city council meetings. You got to reach out to your representatives any way that you can and let them know how this is impacting you and affecting you. You know, letting them know that we need work trucks and wheelbarrows, not bare hands and shovels, you know, doing work. Like, yeah, you can still move dirt with hands and shovels, but you're going to move it more efficiently and better with wheelbarrows and trucks. Let's be efficient. Let's be smart. Let's make the proper investment. Make your voice heard, care about this, fight like you care about this. Let your representatives know that you don't want this crappy fixed wireless. You don't want this satellite that could fall out of your head and you don't even know if you're going to get the speed because of the nodes and hub system versus having a direct guaranteed line to your house. I mean, last I checked, most people prefer to use the bathroom in their house because it's theirs. You don't want to have to go down the street and use a public bathroom because what's the state of that? Yes, it's a bathroom. Yes, it works. No, you don't have to clean it. Isn't that better than a personal bathroom that you know how to, you know the state that it's in, you know it's yours, you know no one else is using it when you're not there? That's what fiber to the home did. That's what we had worked towards and we're getting for everybody. You get fiber to the home, your connection, whatever speed package you had available or purchased is what you get. With satellite, you buy a tier and it's a range and it's a priority and it's subject to weather elements and capacity constraints and everything else that has always come with the issues of satellites. They're not improving satellites. They're just saying, let's send it over here because it's cheaper for us right now than investing on what's good for the people. Okay. So yeah, I mean, talk to everyone that you can to listen and make them understand this is a raw deal. They pulled the rug from under you and they're telling you it's your fault if you fall.
Yeah, and look, you know, the reality is if we're going to be the global leader in anything, this is one of those things you want to be at the top of. And I remember, you know, when George Bush was president, the gaffe line of his is, well, you know, America's 10th in the high-speed internet, and that's 10 spots too low. And you go, okay, the fact that you don't understand math, fine. But, you know, yeah, we were 10th then. We have fallen off the cliff and we're much worse off now. And as I said, you know, I had a friend traipsing around India and he was getting, well, by far better internet than I can get for $400 a month here.
And that's the difference it makes when there isn't a concern of who makes the most profit, but can we get the technology out there so people can use it that need it?
Yep.
And they're not putting the people first in any way, shape, or form. You're going to get a worse technology. It's not going to be as reliable or last as long. And we're going to continue to fall behind until we get those priorities straight. Our priorities are not in order right now.
I'm right there with you, Marcus. I appreciate the time. Keep up the fight. I hope you'll come back and share some thoughts with us as this comes down the road and what's going on. Keep us informed. But if you want to check out more of what Marcus does, CWA-union.org. Marcus Chambers, I appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me. It's good to talk. I would love to come back in the future. Thank you.
Outstanding. What do you think? Is this smart? Is this what $280 million gets you? I want to hear your thoughts. Are you in rural America? Like me? A little ticked off? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Isolated evening storms, otherwise partly cloudy and a low in the low 60s. Sunshine warmer and more humid tomorrow, high in the low 80s. With more showers and storms around Thursday night and Friday, high again in the low 80s. 90s ahead this weekend. It's 67 right now.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Mark Sommerhauser, the communications director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, analyzing the impacts of the big brutal bill.
That number that you mentioned of nearly $15,000 per person, literally about a quarter of the state's economy.
Basically a quarter of the state's economy coming from the federal government. I'm not hearing from Republicans in the state in their biennial budget planning any sort of contingency plan for major disruption in federal funding coming into the state.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, a Mexican trucking company hauling Hyundai auto parts across the U.S. Evidently is accused of firing union organizers, intimidating workers, and, of course, imposing a sham company kind of union to block independent union organizing. The Mexican Transportation Union, CITRAPIX, I think is how you pronounce it, and the group Rethink Trade, they filed a USMCA labor complaint citing illegal outsourcing and the denial of rights. They're urging enforcement to protect cross-border drivers from exploitation and abuse. And here to share some thoughts on what that is, I've asked Daniel Rangel to come share some thoughts and fill us in. He's a research director there at Rethink Trade. You can check out their website, rethinktrade.org. Also, the lead petitioner in this most recent complaint against Hyundai. Daniel, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for the invite, Rick.
So let's start right from the beginning. You know, what's the legal grounds for this? What's the legal grounds under the USMCA's rapid response mechanism support that supports this complaint against Hyundai's facility?
Yeah, that is a great question, because the rapid response mechanism, which is the tool that we're using to go after these labor rights violations, is something that is rather unique. This agreement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, includes a novel tool that allows unions, group of workers, and basically any kind of organization to flag to the U.S. government violations of labor rights that are taking place in Mexico. Particularly, what we can do with this mechanism is when there is a violation to the freedom of association, of collective bargaining of Mexican workers, then we can go to the U.S. authorities so that they can investigate and, along with Mexico, redress the matter. Or if not, the company is going to face important sanctions.
So let me ask you, because, you know, as I remember the original NAFTA before the renegotiated USMCA, you had these secret tribunals that would, you know, go after governments. How did we end up with this rapid response mechanism? How did this come about?
Yeah. And this is quite, like, honestly, the opposite of those secret tribunals that allowed corporations to sue governments. We ended up here because one of the most problematic aspects of the original NAFTA was that it created this common, almost common North American market, but it didn't include sufficient safeguards to support workers and to guarantee that there was going to be fair competition among the different companies that are set up in the three North American countries. And that created a race to the bottom in wages and working conditions, wage stagnation across the North American region. And when the NAFTA was renegotiated by President Trump during his first term, this was a key area of focus. And the idea was to create some kind of mechanism that could allow for workers to fight back and to narrow that wage gap that we currently see between Mexican and American wages. So certain changes were made to the core labor rules of the trade agreement, but also this specific enforcement mechanism was added. And this was only after the Democrats, when they won back the House in 2019, required the Trump administration in the first term to do better in terms of enforcement. And there was a negotiation that happened both between the U.S. government and Congress, but also U.S. government and the Mexican government back then, and that delivered this kind of mechanism.
So, because, you know, here's the thing, I'm sitting here and I'm going, you know, this happened under Trump, you know, given the fact that what we've seen these last couple of months, the attacks on our independent unions here at home, I can't imagine that this was Trump's idea.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I wouldn't say necessarily that this was Trump's idea. A lot of people find the origins of this mechanism in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate, and in the U.S. back then it was called the Brown and Wyden mechanism, because it came from staffers from Blow's office who thought that this was going to be the thing that could actually help worker organizing in Mexico through the trade agreement.
Okay, so now that sounds better. I mean, that's, you know, Sherrod Brown and Rod Wyden, yeah, I see that coming out of their camps. I struggle seeing it coming out of Donald Trump. But here's the thing, and this cross-border trucking issue is something that I've spent a lot of time on over the years, because I was against it from the beginning. I think, you know, you keep your trucks on our side, because you have this kind of crossover. I do think it harms truckers on our side of the border, but given the fact that, you know, what we're seeing, the use of shell companies and outsourcing and all this stuff, it's hindering even labor rights in Mexico, isn't it?
100% is hindering labor rights in Mexico. Basically, these corporations are taking advantage of the fact that there is an integrated market in which it's very easy to set up shop in different places, and then avoid any kind of like really employer liability for the kind of things that workers will expect when you are doing an important, I will say essential job, like actually moving goods across the border.
So let me ask you, you know, you guys have filed this claim, Rethink Trade and this Mexican Transportation Union. You know, what evidence have you guys gathered, you know, to demonstrate like the damage, the denial of worker rights, the standing, I guess, you know, what are we seeing?
So the evidence is very damning and is very clear. Back in 2021, this group of workers who work for this facility that is located in Tijuana, Baja California, start organizing their own union in response to what I was saying, years of abuses and wage disparities compared to American drivers, lack of proper health care, a lot of issues, and they started organizing their independent union. And when the company got caught wind of what they wanted to do, the leaders of this movement were fired. That was in 2021. It was very clearly a union activity motivated dismissal. And after that, the workers who remained working for that company were summoned to different one-on-one meetings in which they were threatened that if they were continued to be participating in these kind of union activities, then these this would have some kind of reprisal, and they could face the same kind of destiny that the other workers had.
Right.
All workers have been fired since then, and it's very clearly that this corporation has launched a union busting campaign against this union.
So I got to ask you this: did they get American Union Busters to consult on that? Because sadly and unfortunately, I've heard that story, here at home.
Yeah, it's pretty much the same kind of tactics that we see over and over again. The good thing under this trade agreement is that we actually can use it to try to get some help from the government to do something about it and to actually try to make these corporations accountable.
So do you think this could set a precedent, not just in Mexico, but across both sides of the labor movement in both countries? Could this set a precedent for future labor rights complaints under the USMCA?
That's the idea. We have seen a lot of complaints under the USMCA rapid response mechanism in the manufacturing sector, a lot of them related to autos, auto parts, other kind of goods. So, but we haven't seen one in this particular trucking industry. So that this is path-breaking in that sense, and that's the kind of precedent that we want to set, that either it's goods or services, labor rights have to be protected under this economic agreement.
So what do you hope, authorities in both countries, how do you think they'll respond to this? I guess, one, how do you think they'll respond to it, or how have they responded, and how do you hope they'll respond to it?
I think that they should respond positively. I have to say that the authorities in both countries have taken these kind of cases seriously, and they have tried to find some kind of actions that companies can take to redress the harm that has been done. The most important one, and is kind of like the low-hanging fruit right now, is the reinstatement of these workers with back pay, so that they can go back to their jobs and they can continue organizing without fear of reprisals taken against them. But of course, we also need for the company to be actually neutral and does that then to permit the workers to organize independently and hopefully when they are strong enough to get a union contract at that facility.
Yeah, because I look at this and again, the whole idea is if you can raise up their working conditions, maybe we've got a fighting chance on actually living up to what we were sold when NAFTA was going to come around, that, the rising tide, you've heard the rising tide thing about boats. But the sad reality is corporate America has used their yacht to crush us. The hope is that this is a small tool to help move in that direction, no?
That's exactly right. It's a small tool, so we have to find other kind of tools in toolbox because, as I said, this is a mechanism that allows you to investigate one facility, and we have thousands of facilities in Mexico that are using the trade agreement to exploit workers in a way because they have free market access. There is a common market in North America, but really the labor guarantees are still very weak. So the good news is that there's an upcoming review of the US-Mexico-Canada agreement that is supposed to start formally between the three countries in 2026. And that's an opportunity to make the deal even better in terms of labor enforcement.
Well, let me ask you the other side of that, because, as you were talking, my mind was going to the review that's coming. Is this one of those things where corporate America or global capital goes, it was a nice thought, but we got to pull that out of there. Any chance that they lose this?
I think that it will be very hard, Rick, because even I think corporate America and generally global capital hates this kind of mechanism. They have learned how to live with it, and there's people who actually profit from it. So the law firms that have been advising these companies, they have created some kind of like an industry out of defending them under the rapid response mechanism. So even you hear those kind of guys saying, we need to address certain failures, and they will complain about lack of transparency, but you are not hearing them saying, let's get rid of it.
Well, that's actually very good news and give some bit of hope, because ultimately what you're asking for is these workers to be able to do what I want workers in this country to do: organize for better wages, hours, conditions, be able to support their families, do a quality job, but also participate in the profits of that company, like I want to see workers here at home do.
That's exactly right. And another fix that should be made into the agreement is that as it was drafted, as you said, like these kind of abuses, we're seeing them in the U.S. as well. But we cannot use the rapid response mechanism in practice to actually flag them and try to get some kind of remediation when these abuses are affecting international trade, even in the U.S. So it will be ideal to have this actually work both ways.
Well, yeah, I mean, that would be great. So what you're telling me then is this is, so let me get this straight, because I want to make sure that I'm not getting this wrong. You know, you've got the dog, but the dog doesn't really have any teeth. So what are we hoping comes long term out of this then?
So I think that the dog does have teeth. It's just that it hasn't bite.
Okay.
Because we have cut 30-something cases against companies that are based in Mexico that have been involved in this kind of like denial of rights problems, but there hasn't been any kind of sanction just yet. The good news is that in the majority of these cases, the governments have worked together to try to find some kind of remediation for workers, and workers have been reinstated. New collective bargaining agreements have been actually signed and approved by workers. So that has happened. But there are cases, without a doubt, where the union busting campaigns have continued and these corporations have not found any kind of sanction. So that's a problem that we need to address.
Okay, no, and that's something to push for in the next review. Last question I've got. Since the review is coming up, what are you guys at Rethink Trade pushing for, and you know, maybe what should we be on the lookout for as this comes around the corner?
So I think that there are several things that we need to address in this review. The first and most important one is try to find tools beyond this one that actually elevate wages in industrial facilities in Mexico to the level that U.S. manufacturing plants have. These facilities are very similar, but it's just that you're paying 10 times less to workers that are on one side of the border just because you can. And that's not going to be necessarily addressed by the rapid response mechanism. The rapid response mechanism has to be strengthened, has to be made more transparent, and has to be made actually bilateral, as I was saying. But we also need other tools to make sure that North America becomes this high road standard manufacturing area in which everyone has actually the right to have a living wage, good conditions, healthcare, and all that.
And maybe we figure out a way to get this kind of mechanism in all of our bad free trade agreements. Maybe something as a bit of a leveler. But Daniel, I appreciate you taking some time sharing some thoughts. As this continues, I'd love to have you come back and keep us up to date.
We'll be happy to come back, Rick.
Thanks so much, Daniel Rangel, research director there at Rethink Trade. Check out their website, rethinktrade.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. I want to hear your thoughts. Surprised this came out of the Trump years? Or not surprised that it came out of Sherrod Brown and Ron Wyden? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that the St. Paul Federation of Women Teachers, Local 28, received their charter from the American Federation of Teachers. That next February, the Minnesota Women's Union was joined by the St. Paul Federation of Men Teachers, Local 42. Organizing separate locals by gender was common at the time. It was not until 1957 that the teachers united together into one local. One of the founding members of the women's local was Mary McGuff. Mary had been a teacher since 1903. She was still an active participant in the union in 1946 when the Women Teachers Local 28 led the first organized teachers' strike in United States history. At the time, the idea of a teachers' strike was practically unheard of. In fact, strikes by public sector workers were explicitly forbidden and illegal. Despite this, 90% of the teachers voted to walk out on strike. The core issues of the strike were improving education, including a demand for smaller class sizes, and improving the crumbling infrastructure of the city's public school system. The men's local joined the women on the picket line, but it was the women who organized the action. Mary McGuff was nearly 60 years old at the time. During the six-week strike, Mary took to the radio. Her voice shared the story of the strike with the public. One striker remembered that Mary was able to cut politicians to threads, but did it in a very ladylike fashion. Finally, the strike ended in victory for the teachers. In 1969, the union established the Mary McGuff Award, which honors teachers for the advancement of education in the St. Paul schools. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I got to tell you, I don't have a lot of faith in Donald Trump or the Republicans to do anything with the NAFTA review or the USMCA review. The reason that there were good things in there is because Democrats had a little bit of bargaining power. This is why I'm a believer in divided government, that there's got to be some things that get in there that help working people. And again, if it weren't for Sherrod Brown and Ron Wyden, I don't think you get some positive things like you got in the USMCA. And look, do I think that this is going to help us? Do I think that Donald Trump and the Republicans care? No, I don't. Not even a little bit. So I have very little faith in this administration. Because look, at the end of the day, for all the talk that, you know, Trump's the tough guy, for all the talk that, you know, he's the decider and that he's got this vision, he doesn't. He vacillates. He's all over the map. He's all around the issue and on every side when it suits him. And of course, no matter what happens, he claims to be the best, the smartest, the most tremendous, all that garbage. And you look at the, I talked about this the other day, that ICE was going to stop going after agricultural workers and hospitality workers. I said that. I go, look, evidently that's the thing. The owners of these businesses are like, hey, how about leaving us alone? We put you here. And better step back and do that. Evidently, next day going after them again. And this is a pattern. And it goes to show again that Trump's really not the guy in charge. Trump really, really isn't. The guy in charge really is Stephen Miller. And I guess, look, if that's what you're into, then okay. Understand, we talked about it during the campaign, that guy was going to be back in the White House. So the fact that you're seeing him really being able to push Trump in some interesting directions is troubling. Now I look at what's going on in Iran. When you've got, people like Steve Bannon coming out and disagreeing with going into Iran. People like Tucker Carlson. It makes you wonder. It makes you wonder what Trump really is doing. My great fear, because I've talked to military experts throughout the years who have said, if you think Afghanistan and Iraq were bad, if you think we got tied down there, wait till you go into Iran. And, that region of the world is where empire goes to die. If you learned anything in history class, that's what you learned. Now, the weird thing is, this could be a moment for the red hats to take off their hats, because most of my friends who voted for Trump, voted for the domestic stuff, the economic stuff. We're going to get rid of the immigrants. We're going to reshore manufacturing. You know, all of the stuff that we're sold as the answers to a failed economy for working people. They're not in favor of sending their sons and daughters off into another war. They are not behind the idea of bombing Iran and getting us into World War III. That I know for certain. Now, will there be some on the right who cheerlead? Absolutely. Because you've got chaos merchants who, for them, it's all about, you know, how much they can put in their pocket, how many clicks they can get, how much interest they can get in whatever they're peddling. And that's part of our problem. Part of the problem in this country is, well, we're fed stuff because people think we want, it's what we want. And on the right, hate sells. I just don't know about Iran. I personally am 100% against the idea. Again, this is another reason why getting out of the nuclear deal that Trump got us out of and was a horrible idea, was the worst thing he could have done. But again, it's the ego. Obama's name was on it. Can't let that stand. And they tore it up. This is a failure of leadership. Now, I go back to the ICE situation. I go back to, first he says, you know, we're going to go after them everywhere and workplaces, all that. And then, no, we're not going to go after these. And then back, this kind of waffling, this back and forth, this I was against it before I was before it and against it and before it against it. My concern is, one, we look incredibly weak. And two, that he allows one of his advisors to push us into something we can't back out of. A lot of the tariff talk, we're coming from a position of strength. And look, I'm not saying that our military is weak. I think our military is the strongest in the world, all of that stuff. But as a country, are we ready to take on what will be a major endeavor? I don't think we are. And the thing that bothers me, and I'm going to finish where I started today. I've always believed we're a good country. I've always believed that we've had the best intentions at heart, even if sometimes we go adrift. I don't believe that about Donald Trump and the people that he's surrounded himself with. I don't at all. And the kind of dehumanization that they run, the circles they run in, I think is bad for all of us. I think what they've brought us is dangerous. And the fear that I have is that they walk our children into harm's way. The weird thing for me is, we don't get the basic things that we need as citizens in this country. Healthcare, education, good jobs. None of that. And yet, somehow they've figured out how to divide us into camps where we're fighting about nonsense. We're fighting about things that aren't really important to the vast majority of people's lives. And yet we're still not getting the things that we want, we need, we deserve. I start with healthcare for veterans. Are we going to stand for that as a country? That if you don't pledge your loyalty to dear leader, or you voted against him, or maybe you love someone that they don't agree with, that they can deny you healthcare? And as I said, if you're homeless, because understand, we're a year on the Grant Pass decision. Could I have been arrested and thrown in jail? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. As always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255 DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz. In a trial that drew international attention, a jury has found Karen Reed not guilty of second-degree murder in the death of her Boston police officer ex-boyfriend. But legal analyst Robin Nunn says Reed may not be out of the woods yet.
She could still be found liable in the death in civil court. You know, this all may bring up, you know, memories of the O.J. Simpson trial, for instance, right, where he was acquitted in criminal court, but later found liable in wrongful death in a civil trial.
Attack Iran or not, President Trump says he hasn't decided.
I have ideas as to what to do, but I haven't made a final. I like to make the final decision 1 second before it's due, you know, because things change.
Trump said the bottom line is not a ceasefire. It's eliminating the possibility that Iran will ever have a nuclear weapon.
If it's a choice between fighting and them having a nuclear weapon, you have to do what you have to do.
Adding Iran had time to make